A very special election. From Fox News Radio, I'm Dana Perino.
I'm Chris Starwalt.
And this is Perino and Starwalt, I'll Tell You What.
I'll Tell You What.
Tell me what happened last night in Georgia.
Unrealistic expectations for closure and satisfaction that have...
We should tell people what we're talking about.
Everybody, trust me, madam, if you are a big enough nerd that you are downloading you and I talking about politics, you're probably aware that they had special elections in Georgia and South Carolina. And the irony, of course, for Democrats is the one that they were having all of their unicorn-sprinkled hopes pinned upon in Georgia ended up being basically the same margin as the one that they totally ignored in South Carolina. But it's essentially this. Both parties, the denizens of both parties, have come to believe that there is such a thing as total victory or total defeat, and that there will be finally one thing that will happen that will vanquish the sea serpents of the other side, and they will finally have total victory, and it will finally be over, because we fundamentally misunderstand what our government is, because people don't teach civics and stuff. But, the Democrats thought that they were – the Democrats said, it's a referendum on Trump. And then they lost, and they were like, it's not a referendum on Trump. And the Republicans, who had said, this is definitely not a referendum on Trump,
are saying
like,
it is.
Oh, it is. It totally is. It absolutely is.
I think that the Republicans might be actually learning how to live with each other.
Go
like,
on.
You know how some people, if they split up, like the dad moves into the basement? And then, like, the family's sort of, like, still together, but, like, there's tension, whatever. Mm-hmm. I think of, like, the big tent as, like, now, like, one of those houses. So, like, there's Republicans living in all different parts of the house, and they don't necessarily get along, but they all have to live in the same house. And what?
Well, no, go on. Do go on.
So, President Trump really, I don't know if whether he just did this by choice or was by request, or just because it wasn't on his radar. But he didn't talk about that special election at all until like 48 hours before, in which he said, you know, get out and vote for Karen Handel. She's great.
Well, he went down and did a fundraiser for him. And Mike Pence did, too. Mike Pence went down there.
No, but I'm saying on Twitter.
Oh, the only thing that matters.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
If you think of what the media covers, yeah. But anyway, I thought he was relatively quiet and like letting her do her thing and did not take offense that she wasn't, you know, embracing the full Trump.
Yeah, but there.
Okay, every time I try to make a comment, you just are a dream killer before I even can get my sentences out. It's unbelievable. So why don't you just tell us what you think?
No,
go right ahead.
No, I'm shamefaced now.
You should be.
I feel shamefaced.
You should be.
I don't even want to talk now.
I don't even want to say.
We shouldn't even have a podcast.
God, we live in that house.
Exactly. Now I don't even want to have a podcast.
I'm not even going to make my point. Even though it was great and our listeners would have really benefited.
I'm gathering that your point is that the Republicans are that the Trump Republicans are finding a way to be respectful of traditional Republicans, and traditional Republicans are turning out to vote for candidates even when they're concerned about Trump.
Does that sound so unreasonable?
It sounds 100% right.
Well, that's what I was saying.
Hundo P.
Well, then what are you making fun of me for?
I was not making fun of you.
Oh, my gosh. You were like pouring cold water from a fire hydrant onto my head.
This is a strong overstatement. This is a strong Bonewald. I don't know what Bonewald says.
He's laughing and he's agreeing with me.
Well, of course he's agreeing with you. You're up there and you're better than me. So then in that sense, it would really make sense.
Listeners, help me out.
My point is, of course, yes, 100% you're right. What Republicans are concerned about, so the base of the Republican Party is probably wrongly known as the Republican establishment. The base of the Republican Party are affluent, more affluent, college-educated white people. And they tend to be a little older than Democrats. They tend to be a little older than the median age.
Right.
And that's their base. And what they did in 2016 was those voters came out and in large numbers, including suburban women, voted for Donald Trump. Those voters broke late. had been undecided or maybe even leaning towards Hillary Clinton, and then at the end, broke late, voted for Donald Trump. They were joined by, in that space, voters who are not or are less typical of the Republican base, which are voters without college degrees. If you look at the latest Pew Research study, Trump has 66% disapproval among voters with college degrees. He has 50% disapproval with voters without college degrees. So therein lies, you know, the blue-collar working-class voters that are not typically part of the Republican coalition or less typically part of the Republican coalition came in and joined basically the suburbanites for a winning coalition for Republicans. Then the question becomes, is it durable? And the best news for Republicans out of Atlanta is it was basically durable. The base showed up. The college-educated suburbanites showed up and joined those Trump voters from northern Fulton County and from Cobb County, from parts of Cobb County, to put together the winning numbers that they need. So that's a huge encouragement for Paul Ryan and his team and for Republicans in Congress.
Yeah, because they spent a bunch of money through that Congressional Leadership Fund.
And they had,
and it shouldn't have been that hard. I guess that's the thing, that like for Republicans, it's like, oh, well, you shouldn't really have to work this hard. Well, but remember when they had 17 people in the primary?
They did have 17 people in the primary. They had a bunch of people in the primary. And yes, stipulated, it should not be that hard. Republicans should not be having to work as hard as they are to win seats in Kansas and Montana and South Carolina and Georgia. It just shouldn't be that hard.
Right.
But it is. And we should also know, we do know, that most parties lose seats in their first midterm, right? In when the yep. president's first midterm, except for what year?
Oh, well, 2006.
No, no. Yeah,
2002, right?
Yeah, 2002, Republicans shattered the precedent and they picked up seats in president's first midterm. But the historical norm, as Barack Obama can tell you, as Bill Clinton can tell you, as George H.W. Bush can tell you,
Reagan.
As Reagan, can Reagan got pantsed in 1982. The first midterm is hard, so Republicans are definitely facing historical headwinds. And in addition to that, again, the president is broadly unpopular. So it's going to be hard, and Republicans should not overlearn the lessons of Georgia 6. This will be tough. It shouldn't take this much money and this much effort to win a seat that costs this much. But for Democrats, lordy day.
Yep.
I mean, woof.
How much? $40 million? Or 26. I've seen two figures, $26 million or $40 million.
It's all an estimate. So don't, I mean, everybody says that they know it's, you're basing it off of, and who knows about the online ads and who knows.
Did you see how the Democratic candidate that lost, Ossoff, he called for campaign finance reform last night?
That's what they need. That's what they need is campaign finance reform.
How about they should recruit candidates that live in their districts?
Well, yeah. Having a candidate who actually resides in the district is helpful, though the Republicans do have some who are running.
I know. I mentioned Scott Brown.
Scott Brown. Well, and also coming
up. That wasn't even a district. That was a state.
A whole state. Coming up in 2018, the Republicans have some folks who will be running that are outside of their – that live outside of their districts.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And the Constitution, of course, the constitutional requirement to run for the House. I can't remember what the age is, but you have to, I believe, have been a continuous resident of the United States. You have to be a citizen, a continuous
25,
resident.
25, right?
Is it 25? It's 35 for the Senate.
Yeah, I think it's 25 for the House.
But you just have to be a resident of the state that you're in. You don't have to be a resident of that district because the district lines do change. But yes, it would be better to have had somebody who was a resident of the district, number one. But number two, Nancy Pelosi has.
I know you're real down on her today in your note.
Got to go. Holy crokino. She just makes it too easy for Republicans.
I talked to a Democrat today who said, but she really is the only one that can fundraise nationally and they don't really have anyone else.
John Boehner is the only one who can be speak. Oh, wait.
Right.
And as I wrote today, the Republican leadership team that lost in 2006 when they lost the House, of those people, none of them is in the House. None of them are in leadership anymore. None of them are even in the House anymore. And for the Democrats, Pelosi lost the majority. Under Pelosi, they lost the majority in 10. And then they didn't retake it in 12. They didn't retake it in 14. They didn't retake it in 16. And I think part of the problem here is who Republicans are and who Democrats are. Republicans are often at a disadvantage when it comes to reforming government or affecting changes because they hate the government and they don't pay attention to it. And they think they win an election and they're like, all right, abolish the – you remember the discussions from the primary. Which agencies would you abolish? And you're just laughing. You're like, you people are so ridiculous. You don't even you can barely fund a campaign apparatus. You can barely run this operation. You're going to tell me you're going to go in and pass legislation to eliminate the Department of Energy? Woof. But Republicans hate the government. They do not generally see government service as particularly noble work.
No.
We have two parties. We have the government party and we have the anti-government party. And unsurprisingly, the people who are in the anti-government party do not prize government service. As a consequence, when the Republicans want to do things, well, I'll maybe make it simple this way. How do you tell Daryl Issa to do something? So Daryl Issa is richer than Croesus. The Cobra auto alarm system. How do you tell Daryl Issa, you better vote for – and he goes, bro, I'm rich. I'm important. I'm important in real life. I don't have to do what you tell me here. I don't need your fundraising. I don't need whatever. So as a result, the Republicans are continually on the brink of revolt because their members are – and I'm speaking in very broad generalities here. Their members tend to be people of – who – prize their accomplishment outside of the realm of government. Whereas among Democrats, government service is noble. Mm-hmm. They love the government. They want the government to do more and help more and be more. And so serving in the government, starting as a city councilman and moving up or working through the ranks, you can tell the difference between the Republicans who are lifers and the Republicans who are rebels and the Republicans who are newbies, because the lifers generally are more deferential to the leadership. They are generally more deferential to the process. They generally care more about how stuff works. The people who are newbies say, ah, this stinks. I don't want to do it. On the Democratic side, they honor those things. And as a consequence, sheep is a strong word, and I'm not going to say that, but undue deference to leadership that Republicans would never engage in. If Paul Ryan had presided over a streak like this of losses capped by a very embarrassing one, they'd be ready to take him out.
Right. That's a good point. But I don't think they're going to do anything.
The Democrats?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm intrigued by Seth Moulton.
He
four tours of duty, I believe a captain in the Marines, in Iraq.
The Democrats are recruiting a lot of veterans that are running.
It's smart.
Like that guy that's going to run against Mike Kaufman in Colorado.
It's very smart because Republicans have.
And then, well, of course, I'm sorry, the guy I just popped into my brain. We talked a little bit about the Virginia gubernatorial race and the Democrat that won that primary as a military background as well.
Served in the was a Army doctor, I believe Army doctor,
yep.
In Gulf War, Iraq War One, and you know, Republicans have to be careful in that way. Is that Democrats are eventually going to stop sucking? There is just it's just in the same way that Republicans eventually stop sucking.
Republicans are just the least worse.
The least worst. That's right. The least worst party. And as we know, pain is the touchstone of all spiritual growth, as my father taught me. You don't act different. You don't do differently until it hurts enough to stay where you are. And for Democrats, at a certain point, they're going to say, "Our minority leader is 77. Her deputy is 78. The ideas and attitudes that are presented for the party." One of the fundamental misconceptions about politics. The Republicans did it in 2013. Well, we need to be more moderate here. We need to do blah, 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 blah. And it's like, guys, who you elect will determine who you are. And there's no funnier prank in history than the Republicans go to all this trouble and say, we're going to be more accepting of Hispanics. We're going to be more moderate on immigration issues. We're going to reach out to women and younger voters. And then New Hampshire was like, Trump. And they were like, no, you can't do Trump. This goes against the autopsy. And then South Carolina was like, Trump.
Do you think – like some people are saying that Democrats can't get on the same page because they did not do an autopsy. But do you think that was
– Those things are worthless.
Yeah.
Those are totally – the Republican – answer me this. How good was the Republican autopsy?
Right.
It was so good that they elected Donald Trump. They elected the antithesis of what they said the party should do. Don't waste your time. Parties are inherently ground up organizations. They are reflections of what's underneath. And for Democrats now to say, we think we should be more Bernie bro like, or we think we should be.
No, they said like Neera Tanden.
Oh, Lord.
Said that the Democrats need to increase their vitriolic rhetoric in order to win. It's like, oh, I don't know if that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Woof. Stronger together. And all that. I mean, they were pretty vitriolic in the campaign.
Well, the one false lesson that will be taken away from Ossoff will be he did not attack Trump enough.
Right.
Now, I think he pretty clearly missed in an opportunity to describe Karen Handel as handmaiden, to Donald Trump. I think that he should have done that. I think he should have basically the best answer for Democrats when running against Republicans is to describe them as crazy, kooky, radical,
socialist.
Do you remember the phrase that helped Democrats in 2006 so much? Extreme, extreme. So and so with his extreme view on abortion, with his extreme view on taxes, his extreme view. He didn't try to paint Karen Handel as extreme, and didn't highlight unusual utterances or positions from her past or her connection to Trump. Instead, he tried to describe himself as moderate. He did essentially – John Ossoff did what Mitt Romney did. He had a small lead. He tried to sit on it and protect it by not being controversial.
Right.
And he lost it.
Right. And also I think that going back before the primary, the Democrats should not have tried to give it any attention to that race.
Well –
Oh, God. Here we go again.
I feel like
you should just have your own podcast.
No.
And Jason can tee up like here, like topic this, and then you can just like go for it.
No one would listen to my podcast without you. I would be podcastless without you.
So then throw me a bone once in a while.
A bone walled. All right. So what position am I supposed to take now?
I don't even remember. I don't even care.
I'm supposed to say what?
No, I don't even. I'm not even going to talk about it. I don't even remember what I was going to say.
I feel like I'm trammeling your right. I feel like I just boycotted your showing of Wonder Woman, and I just feel bad about it. I just feel bad about it.
Anyway, so there's that.
Yeah, there's all that.
And it's not really necessarily any big lessons for 2018 or no?
Well, the big lesson for 2018 is it's gonna suck. And the other thing is, to have a wave, and I said this before, to have a wave, you need one side to be intense and the other side to be flag. They need to be flagging in their enthusiasm. Waves are born out of enthusiasm gaps, especially in biennial elections. In quadrennial elections, a lot more people come out and it tends to mute these enthusiasm issues. In biennials, it's just base versus base. Which party wants it more?
So I think that the Senate Republicans could actually pick up a couple seats, like Missouri.
Missouri, North Dakota, I think is a good opportunity for Republicans. West Virginia, I need to be convinced. I need to see how the primary goes. They're going to probably have a contested primary there. But Republicans are going to be on defense pretty clearly in Nevada.
Oh, yeah, already.
Already. So
by someone who just won for the first time in the House.
Well, being a novice, just to flip back to Georgia, one of the best things Ossoff had going for him, he had no record to attack.
Oh, I know what I was going to say.
What?
That if they hadn't publicized so much, that Ossoff might have gotten to that 51% in the primary or whatever that is, that runoff thing. And then the Republicans would have been like, oh, shoot, we forgot about that. Because if you look at what happened in South Carolina, the Democrat came a lot closer in South Carolina than they did in Georgia. But nobody even knew the South Carolina race was happening.
You are so right.
Oh, and I know you don't even believe that, but I am. I am right.
I ain't saying nothing. I ain't saying nothing.
So.
Yes.
Want to talk about healthcare? Going to see the bill tomorrow.
Going to see the bill tomorrow.
CBO score Friday. Vote on Wednesday.
CBO score.
I heard it's about a 200-page bill. Not like whatever 1,500 pages that the Obamacare bill was.
I think if we started doing legislation by weight, it would be helpful. We just weigh the bills, and we could decide which one was better by which one weighed more.
Yeah, so the less it weighs, the more Republicans will like it.
That's right. Say, this bill only weighs 3 pounds.
Right, like Obama, they actually were proud that the bill was 1,500 pages long.
Right.
They're like, look how detailed and thorough we've been and with changing 1/7 of the economy.
Well,
we've thought of everything.
So the question for Republicans is, Senate Republicans, they have been dancing in the dark. The sort of little SWAT teams that were working together within this group of 13 Republican senators to assemble the legislation have been working unaware, getting individual CBO scores on their part of it, working unaware of what others are doing. Now, this was a smart play by McConnell because it allows Ted Cruz to Susan Collins to remain enthusiastic about what they're working on. I really like the piece that I'm working on, and I'm really happy about it, and I feel good about the bill. And then when you do Voltron and all of the pieces assemble into the bill, there's going to be some, you know, there will be upset when everybody sees out in the light of day what is going on. And then the question is, are they willing to live? Do they like the part that they like so much that they're willing to overlook the parts that they find dissatisfying?
I think probably.
Well, you called the Georgia election right, so I'm just going.
Oh, are you like scrolling through your phone looking for bones to throw at me?
No, you literally actually.
But that wasn't hard. I mean, honestly, did anyone really think Ossoff was going to win?
Ossoff did, and I think
really think he thought that?
And I think the White House did. I think a lot of people. I think the way in which conservatives and Republicans generally went into the evening indicates to me that they thought there would be negative outcomes. And I think the way that other news outlets and other voices were geared up for what they thought was going to be a big win.
I can't tell if that picture that's going around of the CNN
that's
panel,
unfair. That's
if they,
unfair.
I can't, like, if it was take, like, taken out of context or something,
that's
but
unfair.
Boy, it's everywhere.
Well, a part of what Republicans have become addicted to the misery of Democrats because they feel sweet, sweet revenge when they see liberal tears, and
yeah,
they're so salty and they're so good and they just love how much it hurts. And any opportunity that they have, and this is not everyone, of course, but for some, any opportunity they have to delight in the misfortune and suffering of others, of course, is sweet revenge. But I would point this out just to be lame. Most of the worst things, or many of the worst things that have happened in human history, are built around the concept of revenge and resentment. If you think about the Franco-Prussian War and you think about what that begot after getting their spiky helmets kicked in by the French under Napoleon and through that era, the Germans finally get it together in 1871 and they roll in and kick the crepes out of France and say, now you leave us alone. We were mad and now you leave us alone. And so really from the end of that war, which I can't remember the year that it ended, but until the outbreak of hostilities in World War I, the French are obsessed with spoiling for a fight to that they will finally teach these Germans and that they will know and it will be so bad. And they sort of recklessly goad Russia into the beginning of hostilities for World War I, the worst war that human beings yep. ever inflicted on each other. And then, of course, they get routed again. And this time they create a piece that punishes Germany so enormously that it sets the stage for National Socialism and predicated on restoration of national honor and revenge against the French for this terrible peace. And the cycle goes on and it never ends. And if you look at parties in America and you look at what we're doing now, there's a good-natured thing that you do that's like, sucks to suck, ha, 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 and we win, you lose, ha, ha, ha. But the degree to which both parties define themselves, and currently very much Republicans define themselves as the anti-Democrat party, as the party that is opposed to liberalism, as opposed to the party that is itself or the conservative worldview, we are in sort of an ugly tit-for-tat cycle.
Well, that leads me into some good questions from the mailbag.
Oh, mailbag.
Yeah. So here's one that kind of goes to that. Don Fiore asks, is it time for a moderate coalition party to emerge? Moderate Dems, reps, or I guess Republicans and libertarians, to stabilize government. We need statesmen.
Well, sure. I mean, it's always time for that. But it's also never time for that because party identification is so strong now. The tribalism is so strong now. That, yes, there is the possibility that if we go through these revenge cycles where each side is repaying more savagely against the other in successive cycles and we finally get to the point where nothing works and the government can't govern and all those things. Yeah, I think we could see, you saw what Emmanuel Macron did in France. Did you see the governing coalition he put together?
Barely.
I like
skip over those headlines.
Like 77% of parliament for a party that didn't exist 5 years ago, didn't exist 2 years ago. It would be like if Fred Smith of FedEx ran for president, won, and then in the subsequent election, the Congress went 80% for the new independent party.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think there is huge appetite for non-hateful, problem-solving, uncraziness. But the question is, are the voters – you need the most motivated voters are the most important voters. And for both parties, the highest percentage is always in making them as crazy as possible to find the way to just slap at them and enrage them so much that they're going to go vote against Nancy Pelosi or go vote against Donald Trump and just keep them so fired up that they're basically captives of their own hatreds.
Okay, so that's interesting. This one's from Kevin Post.
Hit me.
And he says, the State Department is investigating Hillary Clinton and staffers' handling of emails once again. They are trying to remove their security clearances. He wants to know, how do they still have security clearances?
Well, when did you lose your security clearance?
On the day I left.
So that was it?
I think so. Yeah, because you have to like, sign a paper saying everything that I know that's classified, I will keep classified. And that you, yeah, I'm pretty sure it's like when you sign out.
And that you, the thing.
But if you're a former, I don't know how they still have clearances. I mean, maybe some of them still need to. I don't know.
I don't know whether they do. And I would kind of be surprised unless there are some. I would be surprised if they did because they don't need them for any.
Hillary might.
I mean, she might need a
former
lawyer.
Presidents keep them. I don't know.
Do they?
I don't know. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I suppose once you've been president, you're in that club. I kind of doubt that former secretaries of state have lifetime security clearances. I don't know enough about the question to answer. But so what was the last part of the question?
It was just that how do they still have their security clearances? So
I don't know whether they do. But
we do know that Mueller is going. The special counsel is going to meet with the Senate tomorrow. It'll be behind closed doors, but that, of course, will get more interesting. And Jay Johnson, who's the former Homeland Security Secretary, testified today. Of course, I don't know anybody who thinks that Russia actually physically changed any votes, but apparently maybe people still think that because he once again said, no, that is not true.
Well, now that we have evidence, and part of which was presented today, which was that the targeting, we didn't, prior to, what was her name? Reality Winner.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to Reality Winner, we didn't have any knowledge that Russians had specifically attacked the process of voting. We knew that they had befouled the process of campaigning, but not that they had tried to interfere with the process of the election, which are two very different and important things. And in that way, reality winner told us that. But today, in open testimony in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee, they said, yeah, 21 states, said the Deputy Homeland Security Secretary. Yeah, 21 states were targeted. We can tell you about right here. We can't say which ones, but it was 21 states. And they did try to interfere. And then Jay Johnson said, but we don't believe they succeeded. We don't believe that they actually changed any vote count.
Right. Well, so that story continues.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Okay, here's another. Who do you think is the most underrated president and why? That comes from Michael Morondo.
Well, obviously, I'm going to say Calvin Coolidge.
Okay.
I'm obviously going to say Calvin
Coolidge. You and Amity Schles.
Well, and she's quite right. I'm going to say Calvin Coolidge because history loves the bold doer, right? History loves – if you ask people – historians, who are your favorite presidents? Teddy Roosevelt, FDR, obviously Lincoln. I love Lincoln. You can never say that Lincoln is underrated. I love Lincoln because he was a person who wanted to be, as Richard Brookhiser writes in his book, Son of the Founders, he wanted to – he was not seeking to be a radical agent of change. But the moment that pushed upon him – a civil war, states in secession by the time he takes office, and the unraveling of the founder's vision, that he is basically forced into the space of being a agent of change, not a steward of the founder's vision, but an agent of change. That's part of what makes Lincoln as great as he is, great as he was, is that he did not say, I want to get in there and change the way everything is. He said, I want to get in there and keep everything the way it is, and then was forced into a space to do something different and kept those ideals intact. History always overlooks, because who wants to write your doctoral dissertation about a guy who said, well, things are my favorite Calvin Coolidge line, never go out to meet a problem. 9 times out of 10, it'll get in the ditch before it gets to you. Mm-hmm. Now, what president is going to say that now? We have huge problems that are facing us, and you must give me more power. You must give me more strength so that I can go fight these terrible problems that are going to come get us. Another underappreciated favorite, Grover Cleveland. A wonderful president, a guy who did a great job. And his whole message the entire time was, stop looking at me. If something comes up and we have to go to war or something, I will let you know. Please be about your business, Congress. Please be about your business, American people. But I'm not where it's at. And I love those guys, I would say either in spite of the fact or especially because of the fact that historians so ignore and sometimes even revile these individuals who see the presidency on a smaller scale.
Right. Jenny Wilkes wants to know, what did you do to celebrate West Virginia Day yesterday, since all the faithful podcast listeners reminded you that it was?
Bonewald, it was a savage text. That was a savage, unkind text highlighting a very weak moment in my life, or a tweet. That was really unkind. How did I celebrate? Well, I told everybody who would listen and even some who would not about the greatness of, speaking of Abraham Lincoln, the creation of the state. I definitely ate chicken wings because they are delicious. And I don't know, I wore blue and gold and I was happy to be a West Virginian the whole day.
And you worked on the election coverage.
And I worked on the election coverage. And tonight I will be working on coverage of the president's speech in Iowa until midnight tonight.
There we go. Well, I'll be on the 9. Okay. Alan Rutter wants to know, what political figure from the 20th century would thrive today if plopped in from a time machine?
I think Huey Long.
Mm-hmm.
I think Huey Long missed his moment.
A man before his time.
Definitely a man before his time. The ultimate populist. Super charismatic. Totally dishonest. Mm-hmm. Would lie rather than tell the truth. Didn't matter. He'd just say anything. And they loved him for it. My favorite Huey Long story is I can't remember which senator he couldn't be governor of Louisiana anymore, so he had his wife installed as governor of Louisiana so he could still rule from Washington. And he was in New York at a charity dinner out on Long Island. And he got drunker than $900 and was rude and insulting to all human beings in, near, and around him. Stole the plate of food. The report from Time magazine that he stole a plate of food away from a heavyset woman and said, "Here, I'll eat that. You're fat enough already." And as you might imagine, the folks out in West Egg were not too impressed. And he got into he went into the men's room to relieve himself and micturated upon the trouser leg of a gentleman there who had refused to make way for the kingfish. And the gentleman expressed his indignation by punching him in the face and giving him a black eye. Now, a other person might then go back to his hotel, soak his head, and the next morning say, "Lordy day, I got drunk and I went to a party and I misbehaved and I have to be sorry now." Huey Long got out of there and got out to, I forget why he had to be in Wisconsin, but went out to Wisconsin and came up with the most convoluted story that a gang of ruffians had attacked him, and basically intimating that his effort to help that these were agents of, I guess this was before there was the deep state, there were guys beating up Huey Long in the men's room. And that they were trying to stop him from helping the people, and he was barely escaped with his life, and he was lucky to be alive, and thank God he could continue the work of the people of Louisiana and all of the common people of America. Now, I don't know whether the people back home or his radio listeners around the country believed him or not, but they sure liked him.
What does drunker than $900 mean?
Well, in 1932, $900 gets you pretty drunk, I'd say.
Okay.
They didn't say that out west?
No, I never heard that one. Drunker, I mean, I've heard other things.
Drunker than what?
Well, not drunker than, but like using money.
Well, like what?
Well, you can't say it anymore. Like the $3 bill.
Oh, that one.
You can't say that anymore.
Yeah, you can't say that anymore, that's for sure. But you can say hotter than a $2 pistol.
Okay.
You don't say that one?
Nope, but I get it.
Yeah, because it's cheap metal and it gets hot in your hand.
I got it. Okay, Steve Avazis wants to know, this is my favorite question of the day. What three events in history would you have liked to personally witness?
Oh, Lord.
Not a good question.
That's a tough question. That I would like to have personally witnessed. Well, I guess the resurrection. You'd want to see that. I would like to have witnessed the Constitutional Convention. Or actually, you know what? I think I would probably rather have witnessed the session on independence, or even just to have been around when Franklin and Jefferson were talking about independence. I think I would like to very much have seen that. And then I'm going to go with. Oh. Battle of Thermopylae. You know about the Battle of Thermopylae, right?
No.
Did you ever see the movie The 300? No, you definitely did not see that movie.
I know of it, but I never watched it.
So Xerxes, Persians are coming to finally conquer Greece. And they've brought an army strong enough, mighty enough that they can finally lay waste to these annoying Greeks with their democracy and the rights of man and all this jazz. And they're going to finally come and do it. I will get choked up talking about this. And at a narrow pass on the beach, 300 Spartans went to their deaths to last long enough so that the Athenians, their sworn enemies, right, the people who they had fought and fought and fought, but they stood on that beach at that narrow place long enough so that the Athenians could make ready for war and save what we now know as the West and liberty and Europe and all of that. It was pretty cool. I'd like to have seen that.
Wow. That sounds like something to have been seen.
As you would say in Tradelphia, if you saw that, you could say you'd been to the fair and seen the elephant.
I do. I have heard that one. I was just thinking that my sister.
Oh, boy.
So she's in Bryce Canyon because mm-hmm. there's some like stargazing festival thing with like big telescopes. And
for awareness for cat obesity?
No, this is for stars. But okay. I think she might say that she would have liked to have witnessed the walking on the moon. I think she would say that.
To be on the moon to see it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it'd be cool.
Or maybe like I would be safe in the rocket, like looking
well,
out.
You don't like space, to be fair.
I know.
How about how fat that cat is? Did you see that the fat cat that she, that was it you or her that shared that picture of that enormously fat
cat? I sent it. It's because it looked like her one middle rescue cat, but it was like five times the size. So I was trying to make her feel better about how fat her cats are.
I mean, that is a fat
She had to
cat.
Hire somebody.
Who did?
My sister had to hire somebody while they're in Bryce Canyon to go and look after the cats twice a day. I think it's twice a day.
Okay.
And the gal is like, she's not charging enough because definitely people will pay a lot more
yes.
than what she's charging. And so I told my sister, I said, you should just pay her more because that's so nice that she's going to do that. She'll send a picture every time she's there because, you know, the diabetic cat has to have the shots every 12 hours.
Does she have to take a blood sample from Tora's ear?
No, I think that Angie already did
that. That's taken care of for the time being. Okay.
I'm pretty sure. Okay. I don't even know if you're going to know what this question means.
Okay.
What do you think of the Strauss-Howe generational theory? How can millennials become the next great generation?
Oh boy,
I don't know that. I don't even know what that means. I was like, I don't even want to Google Strauss-Howe generational theory. And I actually am really, I like generational stuff. I do.
So I should begin by stating my broad disdain for generational theory. Period.
Of course.
Well,
because it's this podcast. This podcast feels like wearing navy shoes and a black dress.
I am just, I can't.
You know what I mean? It's like, there's something off.
Are those
navy?
When I said,
and you got to like hold up your shoes next to your dress to see like, And then you're walking down the hall, you're like, I swore they were black. And then it looks navy. And then you go into a different light and you're like, no, it's definitely black. Then you get into other light and like, oh my gosh, I wore navy shoes with a black dress.
I mean, I've been there, sister. I feel you. I just think I should point out that you are among my favorite living people, and I would just feel terrible if you thought that I was if I was a dream killer.
That's what I call Peter.
Well,
on occasion, like when I said I wanted to take a 6 month no, what did I say? I said a 4 month trip. Starting August 17th, which is our anniversary of meeting on the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't sure if I was going to still be here or whatever. You know, you never know what your life's
life
going
is
to
be. Life is short. Life is
long. This is a couple years ago.
Right.
I said, what if on August 17th, 2017,
mm-hmm.
we leave New York
mm-hmm.
and we do the big round the country trip that we've wanted to do?
Like in a Winnebago?
Yeah.
Cool.
And that we write about, and that I'm going to write about it. Like,
oh,
the intention
cool.
is it's sort of about a meditation on 20 years later with a
mm-hmm.
He and I do have a generation gap, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he's 18 years older than me, and we're at this crossroads, right? So if you're now he's 63, I'm 45. So then, even though we don't even nobody feels their age, I guess.
And, right.
But it's like, well, were we going to make a change? So, you know, he's listening. The first thing he says is, "Well, I've got to work." I'm like, "I know." I mean, obviously, we'd have to figure out time for work and everything. Like, I've already have this whole plan in my head, right? And he's like, once I settled him on the work thing, like everyone's going to be able to work, it's fine. Then I say, and of course, you know, Jasper would be there. But the kicker is, and why this would be so awesome and cute as a book and like an adventure story,
mm-hmm.
is that we would get a puppy.
Oh boy.
Vishla.
Oh boy.
A brother for Jasper. And we would take this puppy with us and it would be like this whole adventure. And he said, Dana, you can't take a puppy on a road trip. And he was such a dream killer. I was so upset.
But if I know Peter, he began and he said in a very loving way, he said, my darling,
Well, it always sounds better in a British accent.
He probably said something very sweet at the beginning and very understanding.
He's like, my darling, like, you can't take a puppy on a road trip.
Unlike me, who just opens his mouth and goes,
you're like, okay, well, can we skip generational theory? Because I got to run in a minute.
I know you got to run. I would just say this. This is the one that believes in the fourth turning. That's what that is. No offense to believers in that.
I remember I spent a whole weekend trying to figure out what that was. I remember I read the whole Washington Post piece on it, and there was all these stories about how there's a certain somebody in government now who really believes it.
And the da-da-da-da-da. But my takeaway is this. I tend to think that these kinds of generational theories are spinning out of whole cloth. Events drive shifts in generations. It's not that the generations necessarily drive shifts. I do believe that there are trends, especially when it comes to war and peace, that when people have been at peace for too long, they forget how awful war is and become more reckless with the waging of it. And I think that there are learning curves that go back and forth. But I don't think I believe that events shape generations more than generations shape events.
Okay. The last question I love is Daryl Manuel asks, when it comes to pie, apple, pumpkin, or cherry?
Wouldn't that completely depend? Isn't that just an insane question?
No, this is his question.
That's an insane question.
He doesn't qualify the question by saying it's
how warm is
Thanksgiving,
it?
It's 4th of July. Okay, what are you eating on the 4th of July? Cherry pie, right?
Yeah, if it was a good, like a cherry pie has to be really good, and it needs definitely a very flaky, buttery crust. Apple pie is a more forgiving space. Apple is a easier.
You know who makes a good cherry pie?
Who's that?
McDonald's.
A hand pie, cherry hand pie.
Do they still make those?
I'm sure they.
They're on my list.
Number one, I was going to say, number one, it's telling that you don't know. Number two, now I know why you have the list based on the things that are on it.
Exactly. Okay, trivia.
Hit it.
I'm going to give you the pre-presidency resume, and you tell me the president.
This is Bonewald's revenge.
No, this is actually, you've got this. It's easy. Okay, candidate number one. Mm-hmm. Graduated West Point. Mm-hmm. U.S. Army officer. Mm-hmm. Worked as a farmer. Real estate bill collector, mm-hmm. U.S. Army officer, mm-hmm. Major General U.S. Army, Commanding General of U.S. Army.
Well, that's U.S. Grant.
Okay, see how easy?
Okay.
Candidate number two, mining consultant, director of U.S. Food Administration, U.S. Commerce Hoover. Secretary. Herbert Hoover. Okay, see how easy? Candidate number three, mm-hmm. Sheriff of Erie County, New York, Mayor of Buffalo, New York, Governor of New York, President of the United States, law firm of Bang, Stetson, Trace, and McVeigh.
Grover Cleveland.
Okay. Bonewall, that's embarrassing.
Boom, boom, boom. Look who stepped in the room. Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
Okay.
Well, I'm going to go check and see if my shoes are navy or
I'm sorry. Not. I'm sorry if I was mean today. I didn't mean to be mean today.
No, it's not mean. You're a dream killer.
I don't want to. I want to encourage all the dreams.
I mean, you can't do that.
I know that's
to girls.
A lie. Oh, I know it's a lie that I want to encourage all the dreams, but I want everybody to
no,
be.
But if like I don't know if you could ever be a teacher because people would start to answer questions and be like,
or I could just do the Trump and I could just go wrong.
Okay. Well, that's true. That'd be funny.
Wrong.
If I get three wrongs in a row, I'm off.
Wrong.
Voted off the podcast.
You're a puppet.
Okay. All right. You may always leave them laughing. Good job, Chris. Okay. For more podcasts, go to foxnewspodcast.com. And don't forget to subscribe to this one on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and leave us a review. This has been Perino and Starwalt. I'll tell you what on Fox News Radio.